Well, as we continue our study of the book of Deuteronomy this evening, let's join together in reading Deuteronomy 22. Please turn there with me, and as we will read the entire chapter and study its different parts this evening. Deuteronomy 22, beginning in verse 1 and reading to the end of the chapter. Give your attention to the Word of God. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them. You shall take them back to your brother. And if he does not live near you and you do not know who he is, you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall stay with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. And you shall do the same with his donkey, or with his garment, or with any lost thing of your brother's, which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. You shall help him to lift them up again. A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you, and that you may live long. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house, if anyone should fall from it. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, lest the whole yield be forfeited, the crop that you have sown and the yield of the vineyard. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear cloth of wool and linen mixed together. You shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and then hates her and accuses her of misconduct and brings a bad name upon her, saying, "I took this woman, and when I came near her, I did not find evidence of her virginity," then the father of the young woman and her mother shall take and bring out the evidence of her virginity to the elders of the city in the gate. And the father of the young woman may say to the elders, "I gave my daughter to this man to marry, and he hates her. And behold, he has accused her of misconduct, saying, 'I did not find in your daughter evidence of virginity. And yet this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity.' And they shall spread the cloak before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take the man and whip him. And they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name upon a virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife. He may not divorce her all his days. But if the thing is true, that evidence of virginity was not found in the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done an outrageous thing in Israel by whoring in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. So you shall purge the evil from Israel. If there is a betrothed virgin, and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. But if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. She has committed no offense punishable by death. For this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor because he met her in the open country. And though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found, then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has violated her. He may not divorce her all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife so that he does not uncover his father's nakedness. Thus far, the word of God. May he add his blessing to it this evening as we study it. Well, the laws that are set forth in this chapter touch on a variety of topics, and it's not immediately apparent that there is one overarching theme that ties them all together. Now, it's not necessary to find such a theme, but it does seem reasonable to say that most of these laws relate in one way or another to the sixth and the seventh commandments, the commandments that require us to preserve our own and our neighbor's life and chastity. And as we've been seeing, as we've been studying this section, basically it kind of follows the Ten Commandments, and it's applying them to different situations. And here we get to the sixth and the seventh commandments. Old Testament scholar Meredith Klein makes another suggestion. He suggests that another way of thinking about this grouping of laws is to see how they focus on man's activity in the area of two of the creation ordinances. That is, this chapter teaches that man's dealings with the natural world are governed by the creation ordinance of labor, or work, and that his relationship to the human race and its genealogical history is governed by the creation ordinance of marriage. And I think there's something to say for that. I'm not sure everything fits into those two creation ordinances here, but a lot of the things that are said do. But I think also we could say that the theme of faithfulness is prominent in this chapter and really can be looked at as a thread that runs throughout the whole chapter. Man is expected to be faithful in his dealings with his neighbor. He's expected to be faithful in his stewardship of the natural world. And he's expected to be faithful in his respect for the institution of marriage. Well, looking at the first four verses, we see that the focus is upon our obligation to our neighbor and especially to his possessions. God's law said that if a man's animals go astray, or if they fall down under a heavy load, a fellow Israelite who becomes aware of the problem is obligated to provide assistance. He can't ignore the matter. He can't excuse himself by saying that, you know, I have my own business to take care of. I don't have time for this. It may be an inconvenience, but he has to take action. Really, this is what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. This is a very concrete way of loving your neighbor as yourself. You need to show the same kind of regard for your neighbor's interests as you do for your own. You're obligated to get involved when you see that your neighbor needs your help. That's the basic principle here. Now, notice something else about those first four verses, and that is that at least some of the circumstances that are described here were situations in which no one would know how you responded. A man might see his ox, his neighbor's ox or sheep going astray while he's out in his own field, and maybe there's nobody else around, nobody else to see. If he just ignored the animal, if he just went on with his own business, no one would be the wiser. But of course, the Lord would know. Even when no other person sees us, we are still subject to the law of God. The real test of faithfulness is how we respond when we're obligated to act in a certain way, and there's no one around to see what we're going to do. You know, it's been said, another way of saying that really is, the test of character is what you do when no one's looking. And there is a lot of truth in that. Well, that brings us then to the next part of the chapter, verses 5 through 12. And here we see something very different from the first four verses. The first four verses really kind of, you can see how they're surrounding that basic theme of caring for your neighbor. Here we've got kind of a smattering of different laws set forth here. But I do think that they can be described under the heading of submitting to the natural order that God has established in his creation. In one way or another, that I think is the basic theme of this section. Now, the first law that is stated here in verse 5 is a prohibition against dressing in clothing of the opposite sex. Now, you could certainly imagine how this sort of thing, you know, could be taken too far. You know, you could, you know, somebody could say that, well, this means that it's a sin for a woman to wear pants, you know, or something like that. And, you know, that argument has been made. But we have to understand there are variations in how men and women dress across different cultures. You know, if you go to, you know, traditional Scottish culture, what are you going to see a man wearing? Right, he's going to be wearing a kilt, and we're going to think, "My, why are you wearing a skirt?" You know, it's not a skirt; it's a kilt, right? So the basic idea conveyed in this law is that we are not to blur the distinction between the sexes by appropriating the distinctive attire of the opposite sex. Now, we might wonder, why would God need to address this with Israel? We could see why he would need to address it in our culture, right? But what about in ancient? Was this really a problem? Apparently, it was. Cross-dressing, there is some evidence that cross-dressing was actually practiced in some forms of Canaanite religion. So the Lord makes it very clear that this is off-limits to his people. This is an abomination. Now, why is it an abomination? It's an abomination because it subverts the created order by blurring the distinction between the sexes. Now, as I just alluded, you know, we can definitely see how this verse applies to our contemporary context. This really exposes transgender ideology as a subversion of the natural order. We need to make sure we're very clear about that as we're living in a culture that's really gone off the rails on this particular issue. Well, the next law then has to do with the use of animals for food. And God here forbids his people from taking a mother bird along with her eggs or her young. Now, why would God give this command? Well, there are a couple of reasons have been suggested. It could be that, you know, the focus is that this is on a humane way of treating animals, since if you took the mother and left the young, then the young are going to die. That's a possibility. I don't think that's really the emphasis, though, because that scenario isn't really envisioned here. I think it's more likely that sparing the mother ensured that she could produce more offspring in the future, and that would be a continual food source for you. So in other words, what this is teaching is a kind of conservationism. Such practices would help to avoid the severe diminishment of a species and perhaps its extinction. And that's a good practice. The general principle that we're taught by this law is that God calls us to be good stewards of creation. And then the next law requires that people erect parapets or fences on the roofs of their houses. Now, the reason why this was necessary in Palestine was because roofs were flat and they were used as regular living space. We know how that is. You know, you've got parts of your house that aren't really meant to be regular living space, and yet it becomes regular. Like that basement, you know, that's not all that nice. It's kind of damp, you know, but hey, you need the space, right? You're going to use it. People would even sleep on the roofs sometimes in especially hot weather. You could see how that could be very dangerous, especially if you have a roller. You know, somebody rolls in their sleep, you know. Somebody could just roll off the roof, or you're having a party up there on the roof. Maybe somebody's had a couple of too many glasses of wine, and they step back, and they fall off the roof, or whatever. Without some kind of barrier along the roof's edges, a person could fall off accidentally. So the general principle here is that reasonable safeguards should be taken to prevent needless accidents. And then the next group of laws is a little more confusing. But what we can see is in verses 9 through 10 is that what's the thing that's, that these laws have in common is that there's a prohibition against different types of mixing. You're not to sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed. You're not to plow with an ox and a donkey yoked together. You're not to wear clothing that's made of mixed materials. Now, these prohibitions belonged to the category of the ceremonial law, which ceased to be in effect after the coming of Christ, because in Christ, all of those things find their fulfillment. And yet these commands do teach us something. They teach a theological point. There's nothing really moral about this. They teach a theological point, and that is they remind God's people of the importance of maintaining and preserving purity. That's the reason for the no mixing. Keep things pure. And then the last law in this section is one that I hope that you're all obeying, you know, because it's still in effect, right? You know, you should all have tassels on the four corners of your garment. Let's check everybody here, and if not, we'll have church discipline afterwards. This is obviously once again part of the ceremonial law. But the reason for this command isn't stated here. And so we're kind of left in the dark. But thankfully, you know, if you have a Bible that has cross references, when you come to something like this, look for a cross reference and look it up. And there is a cross reference. It's Numbers 15. And there we're told, or the Israelites were told, that those tassels on their garments were intended to be a continual reminder of God's commandments. So they were a symbol of God's lordship over them. It told them that they were not to live according to their own desires and whims, but they were to live in accordance with God's law. So the tassels themselves were part of the ceremonial law, but the basic principle here still applies. This requirement, this tells us that we do need to have God's law on our hearts. You should know the Ten Commandments, know them by heart, and use your catechism so that you can better understand what the commandments mean in all of their fullness. Now, we too are called to live under the law of God. Well, then we come to the remainder of the chapter, and the rest of the chapter focuses on a variety of instances and situations involving sexual sin. Now, the first is a situation where a man accuses the woman that he married of engaging in sexual intercourse with some other man prior to their marriage. He's saying that she wasn't actually a virgin. And the scenario that's envisioned here is one where a man might use that kind of an accusation really as an excuse, really as a way to get rid of a wife that he finds displeasing for other reasons. Because, you know, incompatible differences wasn't really, you know, a grounds for divorce in Israel. So he uses this as a way to try to get rid of his wife. Now, it's noteworthy that this kind of a situation is addressed in God's law. And the reason why it's especially noteworthy is because in other ancient Near Eastern cultures, a man's mere accusation would be enough to condemn the woman. That's all that would be necessary. It'd be all over for her. But in Israel, God's law protected women from being treated in such a disgraceful manner. Now, this probably seems strange to us today, but it does appear that some token of a bride's virginity, probably a sheet or a garment stained with blood after first intercourse, was kept as evidence in order to provide a safeguard against this kind of an accusation, this kind of a false accusation. So if the woman was falsely accused, the evidence would be produced, and the man would be publicly whipped and fined and would be required to keep the woman as his wife. There'd be no possibility of divorce for any reason in the future. And of course, this is, you know, clearly intended to discourage that kind of a false accusation in Israel. But then also we see that if it was found that the woman was guilty of sexual immorality prior to the marriage, then she would be put to death. This was a capital adultery. Unfaithfulness was a capital crime in Israel. And also we see in the later parts of this section that the death penalty was also imposed when a man and a woman are caught committing adultery in one way or another. Now, these punishments were unique to Israel's theocratic context. We've been talking about how the death penalty was more frequently used in Israel because it was a theocracy. But these punishments certainly do stress the sanctity of marriage and how seriously the Lord takes violations of that sanctity. And then another factor in this, another reason why this was so important, was the importance of being able to have certainty that a firstborn son really was a man's heir. And this was a way also to guard against any attempt to strip the heir of his rights under false pretenses or accusations. Well, then the passage moves on to describe two other kinds of situations involving sexual sin. The first involves consensual sex between a woman who is betrothed to be married and some other man, not the man that she's betrothed to be married to. And this is to be treated as a case of adultery. And that, and the reason why is because of the binding nature of betrothal in the ancient world. We're not used to this, but we see evidence of this even in the New Testament. Remember that Joseph was going to divorce Mary, even though they weren't actually technically married yet, but they were betrothed. And so the only way to break that was to have some kind of a formal process. In this situation, both the man and the woman were to be put to death. And then the next example is clearly an instance of rape. Here we see that a man seizes a betrothed woman, and he does so in a setting where her cries for help can't be heard. And in this kind of a situation, the man is to be put to death for what he has done, for his crime, but the woman is not punished because she hasn't done anything wrong. And then there's one more scenario, the scenario involving sex between a man and an unbetrothed woman. Now, this one needs a little bit of explanation because the same word is used. If you look in verse 28 and compare it to verse 25, in both it says that the man seizes the woman. Now, it's unfortunate that it's translated that way because in the Hebrew these are two different verbs. The first instance, it's very clear that it is conveying that the man forced the woman against her will. But the second instance, and I think this is probably why it's a different verb that is used, it seems to be talking about an instance of seduction or consensual sex, especially since it says, they are found, which can also be translated and is translated by other translations as they are discovered or they are caught. And so this does seem to suggest that the woman was complicit in the illicit intercourse here. Now, why is this an important detail? Well, I think it's important because otherwise, you know, if this really was a case of rape, then you'd have a punishment that seems far too lenient for the heinous crime that's been committed. So instead of that, what you have is, since the woman was not betrothed, now the man has to marry her in order to make things right. And then the last law given in the chapter is a prohibition against a man having intercourse with his father's wife. You notice it doesn't say his mother, it says his father's wife. That makes it fairly clear that what's meant here is a stepmother. This isn't the man's biological mother. And yet her marriage to the man's father made her a close relation, and it would be incestuous for the man to have sexual relations with her. And there's a reason why this command was given in the Mosaic Law. It was because in some ancient cultures, a son would take the wives of his dead father. And the Lord ensured that his people understood that that sort of practice was forbidden. It was off limits for them. Well, God's law, it deals extensively with cases of sexual immorality and sexual sin. And the reason why it does so is because sexual sin is a transgression of his design for sex, and it's very destructive of society. And we can see that. We can see that in our own society right now. And it's no mystery why our culture is becoming more and more debased in its handling of sex. What are we seeing? We're seeing Romans 1 being played out right before our eyes. Remember what Paul says in Romans 1. You know, when sex is detached from its God-intended context of a lifelong marital union of one man and one woman, what happens? Well, people are given over. They're given over to dishonorable passions and a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. And again, that's exactly what we're seeing in our culture. And of course, you know, people tout this as liberation in our culture, but the reality is that it breeds misery and isolation. And we can even see that in our culture too. God made the world with a particular design. When people live in harmony with that design, they find a measure of blessing and flourishing. But when they rebel against that design, when they insist on doing things their way, they're given over to their folly and its consequences. We have to remember that Christ did not set us free from the curse of the law so that we could once again be enslaved by the desires of the flesh. And that being the case, let's always strive to use our freedom, not to indulge evil desires, to just go our own way, but to walk in God's way, which is the way of life. May God help us to do so. Amen.